Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 5th of September. Ira Flatow is our guest this hour, and we get to talk about the brain. We'll be talking about sleep, aging, music therapy, addictions. We'll talk about cosmology, energy sources, wind and nuclear and coal and nanotechnology and space and oceans, and we're going to have a good time. Ira is the author, most recently, of Present at the Future, From Evolution to Nanotechnology, Candid and Controversial Conversations on Science and Nature. He, of course, is host and executive producer of Talk of the Nation Science Friday. He is also author of Rainbows, Curveballs, They All Laughed. He's been a public radio personality for over 30 years now. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for Ira. We'll have more than a few, I would think. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Hello, Ira. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
It's you write in the intro to the book, and I would imagine that in your field of work, there are a lot of these aha moments. One of the joys of being a science journalist is all this stuff you learn, and you go, aha, all the time, and you're doing it with millions of other people.
Yeah, it's the best job in the world, you know. I don't have to cover people talking out of the sides of their mouths, as politicians do, and things like that, but there are great aha moments, and we have them on, you know, the air. We have them when we do interviews. I have them when I interview scientists. We had an aha moment, actually a shocking aha moment a while back. I talk about it in the book. It was an interview I did with Jane Goodall, and she was talking about apes and her work in the field, and we had a couple of minutes left, and I went to the phones, and the listener said, is there a species out there? Is there an ape out there that has yet to be discovered, but that you think is out there? And Jane said, oh, yes, I think there is one. And, I think there's good evidence for it. And I butted in and I sort of said, am I missing something here? Am I the only one who doesn't know what you're talking about? Because I think, if I hear you correctly, what you're talking about is Yeti, Sasquatch, Bigfoot. Is that what you're intimating here? She said, absolutely.
Oh,
said,
I remember
that. I believe that here it exists, and I think we have, you know, fibers and hair and DNA evidence for it, and I think if we keep looking, we'll find one. And she still, and to this day, she still believed that. And that really was a hello moment, you know, where some scientist or a guest says something that you had no idea they were going to say, and here I am running out of time.
Right, you know, right.
At the end of the conversation.
Once it's found, you'll have another aha moment, right, Ira?
Exactly. Yeah. You never know what to expect.
Right. So let's start with the brain here, because the brain is so fascinating, and the whole first part of the book is about the brain, 3 pounds of gray matter. Isn't it absolutely amazing how intricate it is?
Yeah. And you know what's If I had to sum up what I think is the most interesting part about the brain, or at least what we know about the brain, it too is not what we thought it was. You know, for decades, for I don't know how many years, the common knowledge about the brain is that you're born with every nerve cell you're ever going to have, and it's rigid, and the brain is molded right there at birth, and if something happens to your brain, if it gets injured or you have a stroke or something like that, you're left with the injury and you can't recover.
Mm-hmm.
But what is really interesting now is that we're learning that the brain is really plastic. It can change itself. It can mold itself. It can even repair the cells that go bad. And we're seeing research that shows that people who have had strokes or have lost parts of the functions of their bodies, their arms or whatever, are able to retrain a different part of the brain to take over the functions, you know, that the brain was doing there. And what makes a lot of this research possible is we're now able to actually look inside your brain and watch it light up as it works. You know, there are these brain scans, there are these scanning machines that can watch you think, and they can watch what parts of the brain are involved when you think, or when you grasp for something, or when an idea comes, and when an emotion happens, that different part of the brain lights up. And there's even research with monkeys now and beginning to happen with people that people can thought control. You know, they can actually get a mouse on a computer screen or
right.
a robotic limb to move just by thinking about it.
Right. I think I heard that on one of your shows, and
yeah,
that was an aha moment for me.
You're absolutely right. It's just amazing.
It is amazing.
Time for the brain.
Are the differences between the male and female brain substantial?
Well, a difference in size, you know. And there's that giant, that big debate with Larry Summers at Harvard about, you know, whether women can do science as well as men. But there really is not, you know, there is a physical difference, but it's never been shown that there really is any functional, you know, there's no real functional difference that has any meaning in whether women can function the same way men can.
What about that teenage brain?
It is a mystery. As someone who has gone through three teenagers, you know, the most interesting part about that, and this is true, and I have found this to be true anecdotally with, you know, teenagers that I know, the most interesting bit of research about this is the prefrontal cortex. That's right in the front of your head. That's the brain part right there. And what they have found is that there's a maturation process, there's a maturing process in that area in teenagers that could take all the way until you're age 25.
Oh, my gosh.
And you know what area that controls? That area, it controls whether you understand the consequences of your actions or not.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
And boy, if you have teenagers,
mm-hmm.
you know that, you know, well, you go, you know, teenagers in cars and they're
right.
things like that, do they really understand the consequences of these things? And some, it may take up, you know, why don't you grow up already? You know, well,
right.
I have no control over it, Dad. It's my brain. It's not, the prefrontal cortex isn't mature. Yet, you know?
So what do you think? Should we change the driving age?
Is it,
to 25?
Well, I mean, according to this research, you'd have to wait till you were 25
right.
years old, you know?
Right. Yeah, I was driving my teenager to school this morning, as I do every day, and it's hard to have a conversation about anything. So, of course, the sleep thing, I want to talk about sleep, too.
Oh, yeah.
Not getting enough sleep, you know, exhausted, staying up. I woke up, you know, in the middle of the night. He's still awake. And then at breakfast, it's, you know, oh, I'm so tired. Well, you know, maybe if you went to sleep a little bit earlier, that wouldn't make any difference. I'm not meant to get up at 7:30 in the morning,
right.
you know, no matter
right.
what. I'm not meant to do this.
Well, you'll never talk teenagers into anything. That's rule number one that we both know.
Right.
But the most interesting consequence of that is some research done at Harvard that was really interesting that we have been following on Science Friday over the years, and I talk about it in my book. A guy named Stickold has found, and he's actually probably used a lot of teenagers in this research because they're all captive when they go to college. He has found that if you don't get 7 hours of sleep
mm-hmm.
a night,
mm-hmm.
it's very hard for you to cement to lock in new talents that you're trying to create, whether it's playing an instrument or working a computer game, and he used Tetris in his experiments. It's very hard to lock in what you learned. You really, and he found really a stark difference. You know, he's able to monitor people how much they sleep, and he said it's the 7-hour cutoff. It really is an amazing line there. You have to get 7 hours of sleep to learn new things.
And you also have to get some REM sleep at a certain time, right?
Yeah.
Did you write it's 3 hours into the sleep thing?
Yeah, and you know, I said to him, I'm in a lot of trouble. You know, I'm an older person. I never get 7 hours of sleep anymore. And he said, bingo, that's why it's so hard for older people to learn new things.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, he says, I can't say that for sure, but that's that, I think, has a lot to do with why, as we get older and get less sleep, we still need to get those 7 hours normally. But how many of us get? He said, that may explain one of the reasons why you can't, you know, it's harder to learn a musical instrument or a language or something, you know, a hand-eye coordination, a sport, something like that.
Hmm. Why aren't you getting 7 hours?
I'm a night person, so I have, you know, I do most of my work at night. So I still have to get up early in the morning. So for me, it's a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
I watch baseball a lot, so I have to watch those late games sometimes.
And your team is?
Right now, it's the Mets.
Mm-hmm. Good. That's all right. Well, you got to get more sleep.
Got to get more sleep.
Right.
Well, you know, I have teenagers also, and I have. You know, that someone's always doing something in the house. Friends are always over. I'm a night person.
Right.
Sometimes when I, you know, I can't sleep because I have a writer's block. I do a lot of writing, and I'll wake up at like 2 o'clock in the morning with that pencil by the bed and get up and write stuff that I haven't been able to write, you know, for a long time.
Right. And what's the story with sleep? You write in the book that maybe we need it because we have to sift through our memories and figure out which ones are valuable.
Yeah, you know, sleep is, some people think it's a consolidation period.
Hmm.
You know, in dreams, people have been wondering about dreams for ages. Maybe our dreams are our method of working out problems or consolidating what happened during the day. And that would be another reason if you don't get sleep, you know, it's, you have a problem with your memory. And they notice for sure that if you don't get enough sleep, you get your short-term memory goes to hell. I know that happens with me. You have trouble, remembering simple things.
Right. But it is interesting, as you write as well, that here we are. We sleep a lot of our lives. You know, why really do we sleep? And we're so vulnerable. And in previous times, there you were, asleep out in a field or somewhere, and somebody could get you.
Yeah. You know, you had a... we still have that part of our bodies that and if it is the brain consolidation, if it is the thought processes that have to be, you know, worked out at sleep, and certainly in our society, it's a lot more complex than worrying about whether, you know, an animal is going to eat you up overnight.
Right.
Really need more of that sleep now than ever.
Right. Yeah. If people want to take away some advice, which of course they will from this, I like this. Everything we know that's good for the heart is also good for the brain.
Yeah. Well, you know, the arteries that supply blood to the brain also, you know, can get filled up with plaque and filled up with and constrict and give you a stroke just as much as the arteries that go to your heart. So, you know, You take care of those arteries when you exercise and eat the right foods and get enough sleep, I guess, as much as you affect the arteries that go to your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to keep those arteries as healthy as you do your heart muscle.
Yeah. Let's look at the area of memory of music therapy. I love the chapter on music therapy and how people respond who can remember words and start dancing,
yeah,
even though their minds are pretty much gone. Isn't that something?
Yeah, I talk about a chapter in the book with one of my favorite scientists. I think he's probably a favorite of a lot of people, and that's Oliver Sacks.
Mm-hmm.
And he is researching, I think he has a new book out now, he was researching it as we were talking on the air, about a really interesting case of a gentleman who had what he called a seven-second memory. This is a gentleman named Clive. He called him by his first name, Clive, and he was very famous in Great Britain because he was a terrific musician. And then he had a viral infection which affected his brain and basically debilitated his brain so badly in an unusual way that his memory only lasted 7 seconds. I think at one point it lasted 4 seconds.
Oh, my.
Somewhere between 4 and 7 seconds. So he didn't remember anything that was older than 7 seconds. Yet he could sit down and play an instrument from memory, or he could conduct a whole orchestra, which he had done, and stand up there and do the whole orchestra, stand there for an hour or whatever, and when it was done, he didn't remember doing it. But he could go through the whole orchestra. And Sachs talks about there is some strange connection that's still yet to be, you know, understood about how music works in the brain, and you know, how is it connected? How is it wired up? Why can you have these savants who can do these things with music in the brain? And he's fascinated by this, and people do, you know, people have written me and talked about, and I've written about in the book, talk about music therapy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people use music for therapy from just the simplest of, you know, relaxation. You know, how many times have you been driving in your car and you turn on some nice music and it changes your whole mood?
Absolutely. It sure does. Yeah, right.
There's something going on in there.
Right.
And it's real.
Right. Have you heard from people you've interviewed? I heard this once, Ira, that the process of looking at a piece of music, if you're playing piano, and maybe it's true of other, but I hear this of piano, being able to interpret the notes that you're reading and then put them into your fingers to play the piano is something that, that most scientists can't understand how we can do that, that it's an extraordinarily complicated act.
Everything, you're absolutely right. Everything is very, very complicated. And, you know, it has something to do with the sleep connection we talked about before. But maybe, it is so complicated that it takes a while to process. You know, and then you have to practice it over and over again. When you learn something new, you do one of two things. You create new pathways in your brain. You solidify new pathways in your brain, and you do this over and over again. Or you strengthen the connections between the pathways. Yeah, the synapses, brain, you know, neurons are connected by a little junction called the synapse. And scientists are actually able to watch these connections being made. And I talk about it in the book about addiction, you know. When you get addicted to drugs or possibly even not maybe to video games, you create these new pathways and these new chemical reactions at the synapses that are very, very strong and stay with you, can stay with you the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult to undo these connections. That's why if you're addicted to cigarettes or addicted to drugs, you have to stay away from a stimulant that'll just recreate, you know, that memory of that synapse. You know, if something triggered you again, oh, I fell off the wagon,
you know,
I'm smoking again, or I'm back doing drugs that I don't want to do. It's amazing how strong that connection is, and scientists are just trying to figure out how to break that connection.
And how close are they to some new brain drugs to do that?
Well, they're working on it, you know, but the drug companies, as Dr. Volkow of the NIH says, our drug companies are not interested in this. It's hard to believe what kind of market you could have in addiction, you know?
Right.
Or something. But they don't want to be connected with the word addiction. They don't want to have their names connected with it. You know, it's almost like a public relations thing. Although some of them now are being prodded to get more involved in this and maybe working on these pathway drugs. But it's something that has been ignored for a long time because, you know, addiction is a very old, very, very older than we are. So, been around a while.
Ira Flatow, our guest. We're going to welcome phone calls. He has a new book, Present at the Future, From Evolution to Nanotechnology, Candid and Controversial Conversations on Science and Nature. He, of course, is the host and executive producer of Talk of the Nation Science Friday. And we'll go to you in just a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ira Flatow is our guest, and his latest book, just released, Present at the Future, From Evolution to Nanotechnology, Candid and Controversial Conversations on Science and Nature. And we're welcoming phone calls for him at 800-486-8655. Kathy from La Crosse is our first caller. Hi, Kathy.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good, good. I called you once more. I'm also a Kathleen. I was wondering about Ira's opinions about art therapy as well as music therapy. Have you ever looked at that? I've researched a lot with that. I'm going back to school with that, and actually I'm a big fan of Oliver Sacks and read the story about Clyde and other things, but I wonder about the influence of art as well as music.
That's a great topic. You know, I haven't really looked into it, but I don't doubt that it could exist. It's just a different one of our senses now, instead of hearing through music.
Sure.
Pretty beautiful things bring you relaxation also, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can go outside and see the sunset. My favorite thing is I go out and look at the stars at night. I love looking out there, the stars, and wondering how come 96% of the universe, we have no idea what it is.
My focus more is that it's not just appreciating, it's the interaction with. And I think that's the thing with music as well. I see people interact with art, try to do things. They have the same directions and do wildly different things. And where does their brain go with that?
You know, our brains have this natural sort of relaxant called endorphins in them. They're sort of like natural drugs that are in our brains. And runners get this. They call it a runner's high when they run for a while. If you have jogging, you know, and it's that first 20 minutes really is very difficult, but something happens you know, and you reach a little plateau, and then suddenly, oh, wow, this feels good. It's not, you know, it's not very difficult. I could go on for another 40 minutes here. You know, there's this release of something, of these natural drugs called endorphins. And these endorphins might be released also when you listen to music. Maybe they're released when you want to look at art. And these are just natural relaxants that make you feel good about yourself and relax you. And whenever you relieve stress, it's always good for your body. Stress is one of the worst things that you can have in your body.
Right. I think there's something, there's a processing beyond that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I directly see that with music therapy. I studied that as well. And it has a mathematical, there's a problem solving. There's something beyond, you know, just appreciation, endorphins. There's a learning, I think.
Well, we know that there's research that does show that the musicians make good mathematicians sometimes and vice versa.
Right. Let's go back to the universe for a moment. What do we need to know in order to know what the 96% of the universe that we don't know what it is? You know what I'm saying? How do we figure it out?
We need to know what it is.
So,
well, it's the biggest mystery. Well, you know, it's the biggest mystery outside of our brain is what the heck is going on in the universe. There were a couple of discoveries made a few years ago that totally upset the apple cart about the universe. One was that we discovered that there was this dark energy. And this is the major, we found about 5, 6, 7 years ago, I can't remember the exact time, we discovered a few years ago that the dominant force in the universe is something called this sort of an anti-gravity repulsive dark energy that's everywhere, that is makes up 70% of the universe. When you go outside at night and you you touch everything and see and feel and see everything that you can, all those things that we take for granted, all the stuff that we can see and feel, that's only 4% of the universe. You have this dark matter, which is another 20% of the universe, which was discovered a few years ago, a while back. And then you have this dark energy, which is over 70% of the universe, and we haven't got, you know, the slightest evidence for what that could be. It's a repulsive force that's pushing everything away. It didn't happen until relatively recent time. In other words, astronomically speaking, the universe is about 14 billion light years old. It's about 14 billion years old. And this only kicked in a few billion years ago. So something happened that turned on this switch that made everything start to push away. We don't know what it is. And we have ideas, possibilities, but they're all pure speculation. And it's not very easy to come up with a test to figure out what it is. So that's really. So see, you put the dark energy together with the dark matter, and you can feel the dark matter. You can feel the tug it has. We can't really see it, and we actually have some of the, I have a picture in my book of the first picture of the evidence of a colliding of two galaxies. You can see one tearing the other one away of the dark matter being there. But you put the dark energy and the dark matter together, you get about 96% of the universe is this dark, spooky stuff. I mean, here we are in the 21st century. We think we're pretty smart, and we don't know what 96% of the universe is made of.
Yeah. Well, I hope we're around long enough to figure it out. Thanks, Kathy, for the call. Let's go to Tom next. Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
Yes.
I wanted to ask Ira if he knew what the chemicals that they spread on the forest to put out the forest retardants do to the environment, and if he doesn't know, if he could maybe research that, please.
I'm taking notes. I don't know what it is, but I will look into it.
Yeah. I'm sure you've done shows. You've done a lot of shows on forest and how to control forests and what's environmentally correct and what isn't. And
yeah, well, there are a lot of surprising things about forests. I mean, what we learned on a show just recently was that there's an invasion of worms that are wrecking the forest.
No.
You know, like kinds of worms you find, earthworms you find in the ground?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they are eating up, you know, the litter on a forest surface. I didn't realize that all the worms we have are basically imported worms.
I didn't either.
The worms that are everywhere are not native worms.
Where are they from?
Well, the ice age is the ice age, which happened 10,000 years ago. You know, all these sheets of ice wiped out all the worms, all the natural worms that were here. They came from Europe or wherever. You know, they've worked their way up from the south, where it was warmer. And that they are. There was a story we did. It was very fascinating that the too many. There are too many of these worms around.
And so, if there are too many worms, what happens?
Well, they eat up all the good stuff that the rest of the the plants and the forest and the trees need. Yeah, so just, you know, that's the joy of doing and studying science, and it's a life learning experience.
Right,
you know? You're a life learner.
Right. Oh yeah, yeah. Thanks, Tom, for the call. A couple lines are open now. 800-486-8655 is our number. Ron is next from Madison. Hi, Ron.
Thanks. Most invasive species, including earthworms, are moved long distances by human vehicles and machinery and stuff. They crawl very short distances on their own. Years ago, someone asked my favorite day of the week, and I picked Friday, and your 2 hours on Friday afternoons are two of the reasons I picked Friday.
Hmm. Well, thank you.
Please double your workload, Ira, for you and your staff. I want you to continue doing 2 hours on science on Friday, but please start another program, perhaps called Environment Tuesday, where you take the same 1 to 3 hour time slot and discuss environment, whether it's earthworms or forest fires or the phosphates used to put out fires, and weather and climate, everything in between that doesn't that has an environmental aspect. Granted, astronomy will have to stay in the science program, but everything else might end up in.
It's a great suggestion. You know what else? You know what else? I need another day for. I need another day for energy.
Well, yes,
so much
right.
going on.
I figured it needed to be
energy.
About halfway, halfway away from the Friday one, and yes, most of our energy concerns could fit into environment also.
Yeah.
But thanks for the great work.
But also check out, you know, what we're trying to do more of on our website is we're trying to create another, you know, information source by posting stuff that we don't do on Fridays, videos, audios, and collecting more news about science. So maybe you'll find some stuff there, some extra stuff that we're doing.
Yeah, thanks so much for the call, Ron. Thanks. A guy who really likes your work. It's great. Let's go to energy for a moment, and let's look at nuclear energy, because it's been so controversial. But considering what's going on with oil, et cetera, with coal, you write about the fact that some scientists have changed their minds about nuclear. It might be okay.
Well, some scientists believe that if we're in a lot of trouble and we need to to work quickly to reverse global warming. I'm willing to make a deal with the devil, to adopt nuclear energy because it does not pollute in a global warming way. It still has problems with what do you do with the waste that nuclear power leaves you, the spent rods and things, and what do you do with those? Scientists have come up with a way of making safer reactors. There's something called a pebble reactor that looks like a giant gumball machine with little pebbles of nuclear uranium or whatever they use in there, plutonium. But they still have not solved the waste problem. In fact, there's this giant debate over something called Yucca Mountain.
Right.
It's supposed to be, online by now, and it's just been held up because it turns out that after all these years of study, the studies have not been good enough, and they're still trying to figure out what to do. But if we really got our act together, we wouldn't really, need nuclear power. I mean, if we could come up with a consolidated method of all the other alternative energies, starting with energy conservation, if we really kicked in energy conservation, we could knock down our imported oil usage tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
Tremendously. It's huge. We waste more stuff. Mm. We waste more energy now than I think any other country. And in weird ways, look at some of these, they're talking about bottled water now and what a waste of energy it is to put all this water in all these bottles, not to mention the possible risks from some of the plastics that are there.
Mm-hmm.
But, there's a company that ships water from the South Pacific. You know how much it costs and what the energy it is to ship water in a bottle from the South? They have to ship the bottles over there, put the water in, and put them back on another ship to take them back here. So we have to drink water from the South Pacific.
Oh, my gosh.
There are tons of other energy-saving things we can do. We can increase the energy saving of our cars, of our automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
They're not hard things to do.
Mm-hmm.
there's news even this week that John Dingell, who was a very staunch, powerful guy in Congress, has sort of turned into Al Gore a little bit. and he's, you know, he was somebody that very powerful was going to control whether we should cap carbon dioxide emissions or put a carbon tax. And suddenly now is reading in the paper this morning that he's now turned around. And he had a meeting out there in Michigan, you know, among his constituents, and he told them he's seen the light, so to speak. So, I mean, you know, we have the most interesting case in energy, I think, is Texas. This is really interesting.
Wind energy, right?
Huh?
Wind energy, yeah.
Yeah. Texas is becoming Denmark.
Goodness.
Denmark has 20% of its energy comes from windmills, wind turbines. If you go and you take a beautiful cruise into the, you know, the Copenhagen and to the harbor there, you see all these beautiful windmills, you know, lining up, getting wind from the ocean. They have a 20-25% of all their energy from wind. Texas now, just in the last, within the last year, has leapfrogged California as an installed base of wind energy. They have declared that they are going to, be, you know, get 20% of their energy from alternative energies, renewable sources, which will mean wind in Texas. They've actually sent people to Copenhagen. Copenhagen like is like Texas. I mean, Denmark is like Texas because they're the third largest oil producer in Europe. Yet they're believing in the wind. T. Boone Pickens, who is this giant Texas billionaire, has decided he will single-handedly finance the biggest wind farm in America, which will be in the Panhandle. And he will then also finance, help find the financing for the electric lines to take the electricity out of the Panhandle and distribute it to the rest of the state. So here's a state where you had a lot of wind power growing under George Bush when he was governor. And it's continuing to grow and, you know, serving as a model for the rest of the country.
More phone calls. Let's go to Charles from Jackson. Hi, Charles.
Hi, Ira. How you doing?
Hi, how are you?
I just love your show on Friday very much. It's my greatest, best part of the week.
Thank you.
I have for you is Howard Gardner, Harvard University, multiple intelligence theory. He came out back in the mid-'80s. And he came out later, I mean, in the mid-'90s, with a spiritual intelligence in the brain concept, and wondering if you came across that all in your research or in your book, and also maybe a follow-up question too, just the role of theology or religion and science, and how you see that progressing in the near future. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks.
I haven't. I'm not familiar with the spiritual intelligence question that he asked, but I am very familiar with the role of science and religion, and I devote a large part of it of talking about it in my book. To the conflict and the resolution scientists are having between spiritualism, God, and science. And there basically seem to be, you know, three camps of scientists involved in, and they mostly concentrate on the evolution question, the evolution creationism question, which seems to come up every few years and lies below the surface and then comes back again. And you have basically a spectrum, you know. You have a middle, and you have two ends of how scientists view religion. You have what I call the flamethrowers, you know, who don't take any prisoners. You know, they're on the left. They don't take any prisoners. They believe that there's only one way of knowing things, and that God does not fit into the equation. You know, they say that the religion is an anti-science, and as long as the two maintain a distance, the better. And a lot of these scientists who hold these views are atheists, and they're very vocal. Steven Weinberg, people like that. Then you have the other extreme. You have the extreme fundamentalists who view religious beliefs that take the view that religion is that the earth, the Bible, it has to be interpreted literally. So the earth really is only 6,000 years old, and the fossils are remnants of the Noah's flood, things like that. And they try the creationists who try to use intelligent design as their new wedge to bring this into the culture. But I think most people come down in the middle view, where religious views are not really in opposition to science, that they can take science basically and put it in a box and put their religious views in another box, and one doesn't really affect the other. Francis Collins, who led the the Human Genome Project, is one of these, and he was very frank when we talked about it on Science Friday, and I talk about it in the book, where he says, it doesn't affect my work. I'm able to separate the two worlds. I view science as the natural world, and I view religion as the supernatural world. And sometimes they do. Sometimes God will cross over into the supernatural world, into the natural world, and I consider those things to be miraculous events. Those are miracles. They're outside of science. And it doesn't bother my work, and his work is such sterling work, it goes on to show that it is possible to work that way. And I think the majority of scientists work that way.
More phone calls for Ira Flatow in just a moment. He has a new book, and it is titled Present at the Future, From Evolution to Nanotechnology, Candid and Controversial Conversations on Science and Nature. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're with us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I reflect to our guest, and we go back to phone calls to Mike from Oshkosh. Hi, Mike.
Good morning, Kathleen, Ira. I'm just thrilled to be able to pose this question to Ira. A little while ago, he brought up nuclear energy and how this might be our last resort here to save the planet, as it were. And the big problem there is nuclear waste. What do we do with it? There's such controversy. Ira, are you familiar with the space elevator concept, and what do you think about that for getting rid of nuclear waste?
I am familiar with the space elevator, and I talk about it in the book. The space elevator is an ingenious idea. It basically says this: if you put a satellite in orbit around the Earth and it stays there, you can drop a rope down to the surface from the satellite, and you could bring things up into orbit by just climbing up the rope. It's a little oversimplified, but you create that's like a space elevator. The elevator climbs the cable, and scientists have been trying to figure out how to do this because that cable has to be really strong.
Right.
Carbon fiber.
Because just the weight of it is the hardest part, its own weight, And they're actually looking into nanotechnology, nanofibers, to do this. Because the hardest part about getting into space, what takes the most energy and effort, is to get into orbit first. It takes the most effort. Once you're there and you're in weightless space, it's easy to go out to the moon or wherever you're going. It's overcoming the force of gravity that's the hardest. So the space elevator idea is, well, if we just keep this elevator, we make one or two or three, or how many we want, we're able to boost these things out into space. Scientists, as far as nuclear waste, scientists have been talking about this, not the space elevator idea, but the idea of, gee, why don't we just put the waste on a rocket and shoot it into space? And they've talked about that many times. But, of course, the idea is, the problem with that is, what if the rocket blows up on the
launch pad? Right. That'd be scary.
So, space elevator idea, then you have to move it from, what happens if you drop this thing off the elevator, I mean, it's the same kind of, it's interesting thinking, but it's the same kind of problems that you'll face with the elevator. I think the ultimate answer is, if you could do this, the ultimate answer is to take the radioactive material and make it not radioactive anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Find a way of turning radioactive stuff into non-radioactive stuff.
How hard is it to do that?
Very hard.
Yeah.
Done it by now.
Right.
I think the space elevator is the answer, but that's just my humble opinion.
Why? Well, I'd love to see, NASA's put money into it. There are a lot of private people. I'd love to just see the concept be proven first. I'm waiting for it to happen. There are these space elevator get-togethers and enthusiasts, and they all talk about it. I'd love to see one.
Hey, I'll write on it.
Okay. Sign you up.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
How much work is being done, and how big a desire is there for us to expand the human life cycle?
You mean off the planet?
No, I'm sorry. The human lifespan, how
the
old
human
we are.
Lifespan.
Yeah.
Immortality.
Right. Let's talk about that. That's always a good
that's
one.
That's been the hardest thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back 1,000 or so years, we've been able to expand the expected time that you can live. In other words, at the turn, 100 years ago, the expected lifespan was about 50 years old. Now, a baby born today can be expected to live 75, 80 years, something like that, depending on women actually are expected to live, longer. But we've never been able to move that, you know, that endpoint very much farther than that. There are, of course, people that live to 100 years old, but, you know, they're very much on the edges. They're not really the mainstream. And finding out why we can't move that edge point very much. I mean, even 1,000 years ago, people were living, you know, to those ages, but not many of them. Why we can't move? How do we, you know, are there genes that are involved? We know that cells are programmed to die after a certain number of reproductions. They have little snippets in some of their genetic material, and we know these, they're like shoelace tips, and we know that they get shorter and shorter, and when they run out, that's the end of the cycle. That's one of the great mysteries. How do we expand that final point? How do we stop the aging process?
Right.
You know, no one knows how to do that yet.
Right. There must be an awful lot of people working on that, Ira.
Whenever people ask me, you know, are there an awful lot of people working on it, I say, follow the money.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I mean, think of the money that would be made on a product that would allow you to live forever.
Right.
And so they say, do you have something like that? That's the kind of answer I give when people say, do you believe in cold fusion? I say, and there's a lot of research, a lot of underground research being done in cold fusion. Even the Navy is working on cold fusion very quietly. And people say, do you believe in it? I say, well, let me ask you a counter question. If cold fusion is real, why ain't they rich? You know, if you can do cold fusion, why hasn't somebody done it and made products out of it, useful products out of it? And that, I think, you know, that's really what proves itself.
Yeah. Let's go next to our number is 800-486-8655. Ira Flatow is our guest, and we go to Randall next. Hi, Randall.
Hi, good morning. I kind of hate to steer you back to the energy subject.
Sure.
A question arose on a nuclear for me besides my original one was, it seems like with the uranium or whatever, it's radioactive, and they use it up, or they use it in the nuclear facility, and it seems like, well, if it's used up, why isn't the radiation used up? You know, why is it still radiate yet? I guess I don't understand that. If you could answer that. And then the other question I had was, last night I watched The Dimming of the Sun on Nova, and they brought up methane hydrates that are at the polar regions, and they actually showed a clip of the ocean where it's just boiling with this to the surface, and it's actually on fire, and they brought up that there's enough there to equal all the known coal and oil gas reserves there, and why aren't we tapping into this methane hydrate energy source? And I'll take my response off the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, okay. Randall.
Well, as far as the radioactive materials, they don't use them up totally. They're spent, but they're not fully used up. It gets to be a point where they have to be a certain power to actually create a nuclear reaction, but once you use them up, they're not powerful to do that, but they're still very powerful to hurt us. That's why they still have this radiation left in them when they're done. As far as the methane hydrates, I didn't see the Nova, but I remember we were just up in Alaska doing our show from Alaska. And one of the real problems of global warming in the tundra, in the frozen parts of the world, is that you now are getting this methane that is bubbling up to the surface, that has been locked up in the tundra for all these years. The tundra is melting. You have these standing pools of water that you never had before, which are now disappearing. And you can actually stir up the pools and watch the methane come bubbling out. And methane is actually a worse greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide is.
Really?
Yes.
Oh.
And if we start melting, you know, the tundra and the methane starts coming out and being released, it's actually exacerbating the problem. I mean, it's making things worse. I don't know. I'm not familiar with taking methane out and using it as fuel, but who knows? Mm-hmm. I once interviewed a scientist who wrote a book, a Nobel Prize winning chemist who wrote a book about why methane is better, you know, to use than other things. And who knows? We have to investigate all these other products.
Mm-hmm.
Because we never really know what works better until you look at the whole fuel cycle.
Right.
I had an expert on who said, you know, let me ask you this question. He says, which is it better to do? Is it better to go down to the store in your car to buy a quart of milk, or is it better to walk there? And he said, you know, normally you'd say it's better to walk there.
Right.
He said, but if you go down, if it's a long walk and you come back and you're hot and tired and you have an extra glass of milk, the energy it takes to make that glass of milk from start to the finish, it would be better than if you drove. It's better to drive there than to have walked.
Oh no. We don't want that kind of ambiguity in science.
Well,
we want facts.
You have to do the numbers, you know.
Right.
You have to run oil. It's very complex. Energy is a huge complex issue, and you have to figure out, you know, what really, you know, we talk about all this corn and ethanol. There's very little energy, positive energy growth you get out of, you know, growing corn for ethanol. Very little energy on the positive side.
Right. Well, let's go to Matthew next from Milwaukee. Hi, Matthew.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on the air.
Sure.
I actually was kind of going off of the space elevator. I watched a special. I'm a Discovery guy. About helium-3. I know there's not a lot on Earth, but there's supposed to be a plethora on the moon.
Yeah, there is. You could mine it.
And then to use that for fusion power.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to be able to do fusion first, you know. We haven't figured out that fusion problem, how to, you know, do controlled fusion yet. This is so such a knotty problem that the solution is always 30 years away. No matter how many, every 30 years, it's still 30 years away.
Hmm.
So there have been all kinds of experiments with creating controlled nuclear fusion, hot fusion, the normal kind, but no one has really come up with a fusion reactor yet. So
all right.
That would be the ultimate energy source.
Hmm.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Matthew.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Of all the things that you're waiting for to happen that would make this huge difference in terms of energy consumption or life expansion or understanding the universe, are there things out there that you're waiting to find out about, Ira, that you think you will and you'll talk about them on Science Friday?
Yeah, I'm waiting for someone to develop a way of actually talking about energy, of using different plants than corn. There's something called cellulosic. It's a cellulosic ethanol method of getting ethanol out of plants. It's very hard. It hasn't been really perfected yet. But once it is, we don't have to use corn. We can use switchgrass, which used to grow wild. You know, right there, you know, Wisconsin, all over the plains and whatever. It's been growing, you know, by as high as an elephant's eye, as far as you could see.
Mm.
We could use willow trees are terrific. State of New York is experimenting with willow trees. They're great sources of wood. They produce many, many more pounds of ethanol per, you know, unit than corn does. Once we get something like that, once we figure out how to use the cellulosic method, and even President Bush has talked about this, that would be a real breakthrough, I think,
mm-hmm.
in energy consumption, because we won't be dependent on using corn. And once we figure out, once we can work in the windmills, the wind turbines, and have them produce hydrogen and ship it around, and we need a real big mix of energy. No one energy, you know, source is going to solve our problem. We need a real big mix, and we may, in the process, discover that we're decentralizing our energy sources, which I think is good. So we don't have one blackout
right.
here affecting the different part of the country.
Yeah. Thanks, Matthew, for the call. Maybe one more phone call. Michelle from Appleton. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have, I think, probably a very strange question for you. And Dr. Flato, I don't know if you're going to have
I'm not a doctor, but I play one on the radio.
Okay. Well, then I'll just always consider you one. there is a phenomenon that I have experienced for, I don't know how long, probably all my life, but something that has, again, come to the fore of my, sensations. And it happens in the evening. I never, ever spoke about it before with anyone because I thought maybe I was just imagining it or that I was crazy. And a few weeks ago, this summer, I shared it with a friend. And what happens is when I'm outside on a dark evening, is I'll see like this burst of energy that isn't a bright light at all, but just seems like a bit of a light that's burst.
In the sky?
It's more like all around. It's not in the sky. It's
in the atmosphere. It's in front of you.
It even envelops me as it happens.
Yeah, and boy, I'm sorry we're running out of time to figure this one out, Michelle.
I wish I could figure it out. I haven't got the slightest idea. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Thanks, Michelle, very much for the call. It sounds like it might be fun, though, right, Ira? Whatever it is, some burst of energy around you. Well, this was great. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ira Flatow, and the book is Present at the Future, From Evolution to Nanotechnology, Candid and Controversial Conversations on Science and Nature. And it has just been published by HarperCollins. Ira, of course, the host and executive producer of Talk of the Nation Science Friday, former NPR and regular science correspondent, and an award-winning radio and television journalist. His other books include Rainbows, Curveballs, and They All Laughed. Thanks to Ira for being with us, and to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour, to John Treader for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. This show repeats at 10 o'clock tonight. And for those of you who are science fans and Ira Flatow fans and you know other such fans and they didn't get to hear this show, just let them know it will be on again this evening at 10 o'clock. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Thanks for listening. Until tomorrow at 9, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.